Hope in the Ruins, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Mexico City is reeling after a massive earthquake. Dozens of buildings collapse and people are still trapped. But rescue teams have not given up.
They still have hope of finding people alive buried under the rubble.
Meanwhile, Mexicans are watching their government very closely.
If the government slips on responding adequately to this earthquake, the backlash is going to be fierce.
Plus, President Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea. This North Korean military defector also takes a tough line.
Enough appeasement, he says. Now is the time for violence and physical action.
The stories all coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thank you for being here. It is really an incredible sequence of natural disasters we're witnessing. Our hearts are with Mexico today, and we're also still thinking of the people in the recovery phase of those back-to-back hurricanes and now another, Maria. We'll get to all of this today, but let's start with Mexico City. Terrible scenes have been unfolding as rescuers scramble to save people and families wait for word about missing loved ones. Manuel Rueda is a journalist in Mexico City. Can you tell us where you are right now, Manuel? Describe what you're seeing.
Yeah, I'm in a neighborhood of Mexico City called Roma, where a five-floor building collapsed. There's still families, relatives of people who are apparently trapped in this collapsed building. The relatives are asking for information. They've been here all night. But there's also lots of volunteers bringing food for the rescue workers. So there's a lot of movement, a lot of things happening.
As to those people trapped in the rubble, I mean, how successful have the emergency services been in getting them out?
Well, in this particular building, rescue workers have said they've rescued 25 people since yesterday in the afternoon. Overall, there's already been some good news of people rescued. And I think, you know, the work is going to continue at least through today and tomorrow while they still have hopes of finding people alive buried under the rubble.
Can you tell us about the supply of electricity right now? There are also some gas leaks, I understand. What's the latest on just kind of infrastructure, utilities, that kind of thing?
Well, this is changing constantly. Last night, there were many neighborhoods still without electricity. Traffic lights weren't working. The Mexican president said that something like 40% of Mexico City was without electricity at one point. I think that's being improving slowly, as well as the gas leaks, because the gas and electricity companies have also been sending crews out to try and fix those situations.
Do you have a sense of how many buildings actually collapsed?
I think the count is above 50 buildings in Mexico City. In Wow. other parts of the country, I'm not sure. Of course, you know, we're talking about 50 buildings in a city that has tens of thousands of buildings. So it's not a situation where, you know, like a vast majority of the population is left without a home.
So I know you've been out interviewing people today. What have you been hearing? What have they been saying to you?
Well, I was interviewing people whose relatives or friends have been trapped in these buildings that collapsed. And they're just a bit frustrated with the lack of clarity about what's going on because there's different rescue teams also working on the buildings at the same time, and they're getting different information from different people on, you know, how many people are left in the building, on which people have been rescued from the building. So that's the thing I heard the most was some frustration with the lack of information.
Manuel, I know it's been a trying 24 hours, which presumably will continue for some days. Manuel Rueda, journalist in Mexico City, thank you very much for your time.
Sure, no problem.
The World's Monica Campbell lives in Mexico City with her family. But Monica, you're working here in Boston this week. And can I just say, the second time in almost as many weeks your family is living through this and you're away, first reporting on Hurricane Harvey in Houston and now here. I know it's hard to be far from your family in events like this, but they're okay, right?
They're fine. Our building's been evacuated. No one's there. And my partner and our little son, they're with some friends, staying with friends.
That is great news. How did you learn about this quake yesterday, though?
Well, I was here in the newsroom working. I was in a meeting and one of my colleagues came into the room and said, Monica, there's been an earthquake in Mexico City. And I said, oh, no. That was a drill. There's a drill today because it's the anniversary of the 1985 quake. And she looked at me and she goes, no, you got to come out and look at the footage. It's on CNN. Yeah. And it's unbelievable. I mean, it's 2.5 hours after the drill of the 1985 quake. And I you know, it's the timing is just surreal.
And your neighborhood in Mexico City, where you live, La Condesa, was hit hard, I understand. You weren't there, obviously, at the time. You talked to people late into last night, though. What were you hearing? What'd they tell you?
Yeah, up late, wondering, you know, I asked Eric, my partner, what are you hearing? And there were a lot of ambulances. Things got real quiet because it was dark. There was a lot of people on social media trying to text each other and tell people, hey, get to this building. We need lanterns. We need mobile lighting. When things get dark and people were still getting massive amounts of rubble out of the way to get to people who could be trapped underneath, you know, these were all-night efforts. And so it was eerie. I know people were just trying to reach out to everyone that they knew to see, you know, is there a building that we haven't thought about, people we hadn't thought about, and a lot of helicopters.
Yeah.
A lot of helicopters.
It was a nightmare during the day, and then it turned to night. La Condesa, where you live, and the neighborhood right next door, La Roma, they were both hit, ironically, by the epic earthquake that devastated Mexico City in 1985. To the day, right?
To the day.
This must figure really prominently in people's minds there.
Yeah, everyone remembers. And when you go into apartment buildings or homes in Mexico, you know, one of those things, it's like a question that you look around the apartment, you look around the house, and you ask, how did it do in 85? And everyone says,
wow.
Oh, yeah, you know, look, see, there's this crack that's still here. Or, oh, it survived well. Or, oh, no, the building's been built since 85.
If 1985 was the kind of disaster standard, why are people still living in neighborhoods like La Condesa and La Roma today?
You know, that's a good question. I think there are a lot of places in the world where people shouldn't be living or they're prone to disasters, and we still live there. And I count myself as one of those people. I know the history of Mexico City. I know where I live, where I chose to live. It's, you know, part of the city that is really vulnerable to earthquakes. It's not doesn't have a stable foundation. We're on a lake bed.
And a lot of those old buildings presumably are not seismically engineered.
A lot of the buildings aren't seismically engineered, but what made me feel okay about living back in this neighborhood again was that a lot of standards had changed. Building codes, you know, most prominently. A lot of lessons had been learned, and frankly, you know, it's a beautiful part of the city. Mexico City, it's this massive city. You want to live in a place that's central. You don't want to live on the outskirts and be spending 2 to 3 hours to get anywhere on your car. It's leafy. There's green space. There's cafes. It's well connected, they say in Spanish. You know, it's a beautiful part of the city, but part of that comes with a danger that we're all kind of rediscovering and reliving right now.
So back to the quake in 1985, it's such a reference point for Mexico City. What was the government's response to it? How have they kind of changed earthquake routines?
When you ask people about 85, when people remember 1985, one of the things that really marked that time was the lack of government response. So the president at the time, Miguel de la Madrid, was silent for like a famous, you know, more than a day. It was like, where is he? Where's the response? And meantime, everyone's pouring out to the affected areas and just, you know, diving in, pulling the rubble out, trying to pull people out. Thousands of people were left dead. And it was a watershed moment politically because of that silence and because of the lack of response. And it was notable. It exposed corruption. It exposed a political vacuum. And since 1985, you had major political shifts as a result. You had the building of civil society organizations, human rights organizations, a political opposition that came to power in the city of Mexico that remains in power in Mexico City, that is a political force. So when you look at 85, I mean, like I was saying earlier, not only does it mark people's lives in terms of where they were and how they were, you know, shaken and trying to seek safety, but also politically a major shift when it came to how people saw, you know, what does the government do for us? Where's the response? Where's the accountability? And that survives to this day. And people are going to be watching that real carefully over the next several weeks as the city recovers.
Well, I was going to say, there is a lot on the line for Mexico's government today, isn't there? I mean, how crucial politically is it that they get this recovery right?
It's absolutely crucial. It's crucial for the mayor of Mexico City, who has political aspirations, you know, beyond Mexico City. It's critical for the federal government. The president, Enrique Peña Nieto, is extremely unpopular. We've seen, you know, horrible human rights abuses under his government. Violence is up across the nation. And if the government slips on responding adequately to this earthquake, the backlash is going to be fierce.
So your neighbors, Monica, in La Condesa, are they preparing to go back and live in their homes at some point, in their apartments? What's the plan?
Well, a couple of people I know have lost their apartments altogether, flattened.
Wow.
Flattened. And I know a couple of people whose, you know, their apartments are okay. They're inviting everyone over their homes. Hey, camp at my house for a couple of weeks. I'm going to go camp out at a friend's house in a more stable part of the city. I'm worried about aftershocks. I don't know when we'll be let in our back into our building. We're waiting for inspectors. That's going to be kind of the next logistical nightmare. Is everybody wants an inspector to come through their home now. And, it, you know, it's a beautiful neighborhood. These are neighborhoods that, you know, you have this mishmash of architecture, colonial next to new, and it's always been kind of its charm. But those dangers of instability that really are, you know, affect every building are there. And we'll see how these neighborhoods change. Will people decide that these are the places they want to live and continue living in?
Duplicate your concerns, Monica, by several million. That's what Mexicans who are in the capital are facing. Incredible. The world's Monica Campbell, who helms our Global Nation desk and is a Mexico City resident. Thank you very much. We're glad all of yours are safe.
Thanks so much, Marco. Thanks.
Germans go to the polls this weekend. Chancellor Angela Merkel is looking to retain her hold on power, but anti-immigrant sentiment is fueling the rise of far-right parties, parties like Alternative for Germany, known by its German acronym AFD. The BBC's Jenny Hill has this report from Berlin.
Peter Reffert guides his little boat down the River Spree. He tells us he intends to help AFD. On deck, the party's blue flags flutter in the wind. This salty sea dog in his captain's hat isn't just voting AFD. He's launched his very own one-man campaign cruise.
The biggest Vorwurf, den ich persönlich Ihnen machen muss.
My biggest problem is that the immigrants do absolutely nothing to integrate. They arrive in droves and they create ghettos where not even the police dare to go and where they only live by their own laws.
The voice of the right is growing louder. AfD supporters heckling Angela Merkel on the campaign trail.
Für die christlich-demokratische Union.
They won't topple the German Chancellor, but the party is likely to get a say in Parliament. For the first time since the Second World War, MPs from the far right are expected to take seats. In the state of Mecklenburg-Vorpommern, polls suggest one in five voters support AfD.
Mrs. Merkel has made a lot of mistakes. People up here realize that.
Leif Erik Holm is standing directly against the Chancellor in her own constituency.
They're upset about a lot of things. It began with the euro crisis, which cost us billions, and where she broke the law. Her nuclear power policy was wrong. And of course, she caused the refugee crisis in 2015 by single-handedly opening the borders.
Anti-migrant, anti-Islam. This is a straightforward campaign. One poster shows a pregnant white woman. New Germans, it reads. We make them ourselves.
The vast majority of Germans are horrified still by AfD, by its xenophobic rhetoric, by its nationalism. It appeals, of course, to voters who are fed up with Angela Merkel and her refugee politics. But there's a broader appeal here too. AfD is attracting people who feel forgotten, ignored even by Germany's centrist politics and its mainstream political parties.
My colleague at the BBC, Jenny Hill, there in Berlin. Just ahead, a statue raises eyebrows in Russia. You're with the world.
I like words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple. Jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. America has the Colt revolver, Russia has the Kalashnikov, and just as America honored Samuel Colt with a statue in Hartford, Connecticut more than a century ago, Russia has now built a monument to Mikhail Kalashnikov, inventor of the AK-47. The statue was unveiled yesterday. Kalashnikov and his rifles changed the world and changed history. So the world's own history guy, Chris Wolfe, wanted to share some thoughts.
Here's a chilling sound for anyone who's ever been on the receiving end. That's a Kalashnikov AK-74 firing on automatic and semi-automatic. I was at the receiving end of a single shot when I was working as a BBC reporter in Afghanistan in 1991. A shepherd boy fired on our truck just to make us stop and give him some bakshish, a bribe. Thankfully, he missed. We stopped anyway just to be safe and managed to talk our way out of the attempted extortion. But the story tells you a lot about the AK. It's simple enough to be used by a shepherd boy, and it's cheap enough for him to afford. And it's not super accurate. However, the Kalashnikov rifle in all its forms is the most popular weapon ever made. It's killed more people than any other single weapon, including the atomic bomb. Its Russian designer, Mikhail Kalashnikov, died in 2013, aged 94. Service members here joke that if you dug him up after 4 years in the dirt, you could clean him up and he'd be as good as new, in the same way his weapon would be. That gives you a sense of how resilient and reliable the Kalashnikov rifle is, and how respected it is, too. For Russia, it's a cultural icon. That's a military band playing the Russian national anthem at the unveiling of the new statue honoring Kalashnikov in Moscow yesterday. There were speeches and a full honor guard in dress uniforms and carrying, of course, Kalashnikovs. An Orthodox priest in full regalia sprinkled holy water on the statue. It stands on a pedestal in a little square on Moscow's busy Garden Ring thoroughfare. Kalashnikov is wearing a bomber jacket and clutching one of his creations.
Это воплощение самых лучших черт русского человека.
Russia's culture minister, Vladimir Medinsky, delivered the main speech. He called the AK a cultural brand for Russia. It's true, you can buy Kalashnikov tchotchkes at a special shop at the airport, and all this fits with the Kremlin's efforts to glorify the Russian and Soviet past. That elevation of the AK into a cultural phenomenon, though, makes some Russians uncomfortable. They say it puts this killing machine on a par with brands like Coke for America or Champagne for France. A protester was arrested at the unveiling after pulling out a sign saying, "A creator of weapons is a creator of death." Kalashnikov himself might agree. He never profited from the sales and licensing deals that, over the years, supplied the armies of 80 nations and countless guerrilla forces. He was proud of his work, but just before his death, he wrote a public letter to the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, expressing his regret that his rifle had become a weapon for criminals and child soldiers, and confessing that, quote, "My spiritual pain is unbearable." For the world, I'm Chris Wolfe.
Here's a story of another controversy in Russia. It's about a new film called Matilda. No, not Matilda, the musical. Here's my BBC colleague Sarah Rainsford in Moscow to explain.
Kshesinska.
It is the love story of a ballerina and a future czar. But a new film about Nicholas Romanoff and Matilda Kshesinskaya has ignited passionate debate here in Russia. And this month, that fight turned violent. In Ekaterinburg, a man drove a van loaded with gas canisters into an empty cinema, sending the foyer up in flames. Days earlier, someone had firebombed the film director's studio. And then last week, the office of his lawyer was attacked.
They were in masks, they were in the hoods. They came to the street, take, like, you know, Molotov cocktail, and they burned two cars. It was
Konstantin Dobrynin started to work with the director of Matilda after a Russian MP began campaigning to get the film banned. With its passionate love scenes, she insisted it was an insult to Nicholas II, who's an Orthodox saint. But prosecutors found nothing illegal, and Russia's culture ministry cleared Matilda for release. Then the threats and the attacks intensified.
After the cars were burned, so they put on the street a lot of, like, flyers, you know. On the flyers it was, like, "Burn for the Matilda." I think it's dangerous. Of course it's dangerous. And if the state will not do nothing with that, right now I think the situation could be much worse.
A few months back, I met Matilda at the studio, or at least the actress, as she revoiced her role. In the control room was the film's director, Alexei Uchitil. The protests at that point were harmless, and he shrugged them off. But Russia's main cinema chain has now refused to screen Matilda, worried about security after the latest violent attacks. And so, when I met Alexey Uchitil again, he warned that move was a serious threat to the arts.
It's a stab in the back, because this is not just about my film. If we give in to this small but aggressive element, then the same thing can happen to any play or any film. We have to fight this. Not showing Matilda is a blow against all films, against all art, and against the viewers.
At this religious procession through St. Petersburg last week, one group of activists carried a banner calling Matilda a slap in the face. The fact that the film's based on a true love story is irrelevant to them. And whilst a spokesman for the church has condemned the violence, he also accused the filmmakers of spitting on the memory of Nicholas II. Andrei Karmuchin feels the same. His own group of religious activists has risen in prominence here as an increasingly conservative Russia has stressed its orthodox roots and values. When I meet Andrei, he's wearing a T-shirt stamped with an image of Nicholas II. He denies any link to the arson attacks, but he warns that campaigning to block Matilda from reaching the big screen will continue.
The Tsar is shown as lecherous and his wife as a witch. It's a desecration of orthodoxy, so we oppose it, because it's a blasphemous and mocking lie. It insults the memory of holy people.
Despite everything, Alexey Uchitil told me the gala premiere of his film is still set for next month. But it feels like the fight over Matilda and over the bigger issue of artistic freedom here is set to rage on.
That's the BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Hurricane Maria is wreaking havoc in the Caribbean. In Florida, folks are still trying to recover from Irma. Miami's Haitian community has been taking care of themselves and others.
A lot of these Haitian moms were feeding their neighbors as well. It's like, oh, I made, you know, a pot of beans, or I made some fish. You want some?
That story's still ahead right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We began the first half of the show today talking about the earthquake in Mexico City, but let's not forget the people who are in the path of Hurricane Maria, St. Croix, Puerto Rico, Dominica, places that simply don't look like they used to. Before Maria, Irma tore through the Caribbean and South Florida. And get this, 10 days after Irma, parts of Miami only got power back yesterday. That led reporter Nadege Green at WLRN in Miami to some interesting observations, like how many people were forced to cook outside on charcoal grills. That's a video Nadege posted on Facebook of a Haitian woman in her neighborhood cooking a traditional pot of cornmeal and black beans. The pot sits right on a charcoal fire.
We saw this after Hurricane Andrew, too. I was a child then, but I remember vividly on my block that, you know, Haitian families were cooking full meals. Like, because in Haiti, le chaud charbon, that's how you cook if you're in the countryside. You don't have a stove. Someone remarked that I interviewed a few days ago that this forced his mom to resort to living as if she was in Haiti again. He was like, ideally, that's not why she came to the U.S., but it's good that she had those skills, because without power, even though the stores were open, power was off, so people could not, like, buy meat, for example, and put it in their fridge. But his mom was like, and other moms have been going out and buying food for the day. So they'll go buy fish or chicken and cook that stewed chicken or stewed fish over charcoal and just eat enough for the day, but they couldn't keep leftovers. And I know like within the neighborhood, a lot of these Haitian moms were feeding their neighbors as well. So they were sharing the food among themselves. So it definitely got neighbors out of their homes and talking to one another again.
So school reopened this week. I imagine that came as a relief to some families with kids.
Absolutely. I went out to North Miami Elementary School, which is in North Miami-Dade. It is a school with predominantly Haitian population as well. And some of the moms at the school were happy that school opened because they didn't have food at home. Many of our families are food insecure here in South Florida on a regular day when there's a hurricane that compounds that. There's even less access to resources, to food and things like that. So one mom, she told me she was just happy school was open because she knew her child would get at least two meals a day without her worrying where that was going to come from in the absence of no electricity and no way to actually go out and spend money.
I mean, this is something you look at, Nadej, how natural disasters highlight income inequality. What have you been hearing from some communities and how they see the response of the city of Miami in the aftermath of Irma?
I think it has been a mixed response, but largely when it comes to infrastructure, the idea that, you know, the homes fared well and things like that, people have positive responses. In a lot of the lower income communities in Miami, for example, they also tend to be higher, so you don't have issues with flooding. So people don't have many questions on infrastructure other than the power. Many are very upset that they've been without power as of yesterday for like 10 days.
But that is also a long time. People need to imagine what it's like to be without power for 10 days.
Yes, yesterday it made it 10 days for many families, including myself. I was without power for 10 days. But when it comes to, again, when we're talking about food insecurity, that was a really big issue. I went to a facility where it's an elderly area, and there were people who couldn't take their diabetic medication because they hadn't eaten since the day before or maybe a day and a half before. And so those are very real stories in our own backyard. And I think in that group, it would be a very low score because there was not immediate response, right? People need a couple of days to be able to get food, to be able to get their cavalry out into these communities to feed them. But in the absence of that, there's about a 3-day waiting period where people still don't have anything.
Perhaps that explains some of the social media bragging about the food some of these Haitians you met are cooking outside.
There definitely has been like a social media post among young Haitians who are videotaping their mothers or their grandmothers who've resorted back to what they know from Haiti, which is cooking on réchauffe charbon or charcoal stoves. And so this was just also a reminder of our Caribbean roots here in South Florida, where people resorted back to what they know from the countryside.
Did you cook anything outdoors over the last 10 days?
I am not that skilled, but my mother did.
Nadej Green, a reporter with WLRN in Miami. Thanks so much for your time, Nadej.
Thanks for having me.
Starting life in a new country, even without hurricanes, is not easy, especially for refugees. Culture shock can kick in over food, languages, even health care. Like for some women from conservative Muslim families, U.S. health care practices can clash with what they're used to. That's been the case in Buffalo, New York, a city with more and more refugees from countries like Somalia, Syria, and Iraq. Sarah Varney has our story.
The kitchen in this tidy home in Buffalo is buzzing. Five Iraqis live here, refugees. Some are related. Others were neighbors in Baghdad and escaped the war together. A young Iraqi woman in a neon pink T-shirt makes dinner, stirring a pot of eggplant, onion, and potatoes. A young girl spins around with a butterfly net in her hand. And then there's Salima Abdullah Khalifa, the house matriarch. She came here after her husband, brother, and three sons were killed in war. Restarting life in Buffalo has been tough. Certain things are new, including health care. Khalifa isn't used to having a primary doctor or going for checkups, even when she's not sick.
We don't have primary doctor in my country. We don't have primary doctor. So now everyone has like primary doctor check, physical check every year.
That's Khalifa's friend translating. Khalifa says that only the very sick or the rich got medical care when she was growing up in Iraq. But what's most distressing here for Khalifa is the pap smear, the screening test for cervical cancer that for some conservative and Muslim women is a profound threat. One of Khalifa's friends here, Lamia Monti, talks about this. She's 29, also from Iraq, and expected to be a virgin when she marries.
They said, this is a bad girl. We can't marry you. Until she's married, nobody touch her.
I say that in the U.S., women are supposed to have their first pap around age 21, even if they're not sexually active. Hearing that, Khalifa throws her arms up in disbelief. The translator tells her again, yes, even virgins get the test.
So I'm telling her, in America, they don't care if you're virgin or not. They should do it.
No.
Just make sure she's fine.
And she says what?
No.
She looks horrified.
Yeah. Khalifa is 51. She had her first pap test at age 45 here in Buffalo. Physicians who treat refugee women say it's not uncommon to find undiagnosed cervical cancer. In Buffalo, Dr. Magda Osman, originally from Egypt, says many of her refugee patients eventually agree to a pap test once they understand the health benefits. But for women who still object, she tries to explain that Islam doesn't prevent them from taking care of their health.
A lot of cultural issues may not be religious issues, but they're so ingrained in people that they don't know the difference.
Osman says that the unmarried women she sees often fear a pap test will break their hymen, a membrane that partially covers the vagina. In many cultures, bleeding after intercourse signals the loss of virginity. But Osman says it's the strict culture, not the Quran, enforcing that idea.
A certain percentage of women will not bleed on the first time that they're sexually active. But if you go to many cultures around the world, if there's no blood, then that woman is actually ostracized. But that's not religion.
So how are you feeling?
At the Jericho Road Health Clinic in Buffalo, the staff is well-versed in these cultural beliefs. Nurse Heidi Nowak examines a pregnant Somali woman wearing a traditional head covering and robe.
You're measuring perfect, 30 centimeters, you're 30 weeks pregnant.
Nowak says she doesn't push patients to violate their beliefs, but she will advocate for their health. She also finds many of her patients have questions about sex.
Some of the young Iraqi women will come to me, they're planning to get married in 2 months, and they want to be prepared. So they'll ask me questions about it. What does sex feel like, and how does it work? And then I'll even have them come to me afterwards saying, it was terrible.
Nowak also says the clinic has hired more women health providers, since so many of their female patients do not want to be examined by a male doctor. Not far from the clinic, I visit with two women, refugees from Somalia. They sit in a Spartan apartment while their children play. The women are pregnant and avoid male doctors. One of the women, Karisha Noor, says only her husband is allowed to look at her.
In my culture, I'm not allowed a man to look at me.
And what would happen? What would be your experience or your feeling if another man did?
It's like I'm doing something bad to my husband. Like I'm failing his rights.
I ask, what would they do in an emergency if only a male doctor is available? Noor translates for her friend, Fatima Abdi Noor.
If there's no other female to help you and you're in a situation where it's emergency and you need that care, God give us this opportunity, then it's okay. A male physician can help you give birth. Yeah. And she said it's not a sin. It's like just a way of like God knows you didn't do that on purpose. So
Fatima Abdi Noor was in a refugee camp in Kenya with little medical care during her past pregnancies. Now in the U.S., she welcomes prenatal checkups, even if her culture and religion collide with some healthcare practices. It gives me peace, she says, because I know the baby is healthy. For The World, Sarah Varney, Buffalo, New York.
Sarah's story was made possible with support from Kaiser Health News. The phrase was unforgettable. Totally destroy. That's what President Trump threatened to do to North Korea yesterday in his address to the United Nations. So how does that threat go down across the border in South Korea? Our BBC colleague Gabriel Gatehouse has just returned from a trip to the DMZ.
Did not take a photograph of that building to your left. Did not take a photograph of your well tower.
A burly American soldier shows us around. Selfies are fine, he says. So long as we're pointing north.
Has anything changed because of the kind of tensions around the
UK? We're so close that our security is always as pretty high as it is. So
we're right on the border now. There's a North Korean soldier perhaps 30 meters away peering at us through binoculars. When we talk about tensions on the Korean Peninsula, this is where they reach their apex.
All right, so welcome to the MAC building. Anytime there's like the big meetings that come, that has to do with the armistice.
The Korean War ended in 1953, not with a peace deal, but with an armistice agreement, a ceasefire. Officially, the United States and North Korea are still at war. When the two sides need to talk to each other, they do so in these blue huts that straddle the border.
We actually picked up a fisherman. Well, I'm pretty sure it was a North Korean fisherman. And we picked him up, and he wanted to go back. So we had to set up a meeting. We had to set up a date in which we did a turnover between him and them. So we all had our troops around.
What are the relations like? Are they friendly or?
No, they're not friendly. I mean, they hate us.
So one of the things about all these rituals is that they make the whole situation feel more safe. It's ritualized. Nothing can possibly go wrong. The worry, of course, is that it's a false sense of security.
In Seoul, we went to a demonstration outside the US embassy. A group of North Korean defectors think that the Trump administration may be the answer to their prayers. They want regime change. South Korea and the international community have been too soft on Kim Jong-un, one of the demonstrators tells me. His name is Jung-hun Choi. He's a defector from the North Korean military. Enough appeasement, he says. Now is the time for violence and physical action. But many South Koreans see things rather differently. Right next to the defectors' demo, a counter-demo.
Over there, they're saying, let's start a war. Over here, they're saying, American military, get out of here.
South Korea's current government has traditionally taken a conciliatory approach towards North Korea, but after the recent nuclear and ballistic tests, Seoul has agreed to the deployment of more American missiles, and these demonstrators want them out. The United States still has around 30,000 troops on the Korean Peninsula. As any North Korean will tell you, everything Pyongyang says and does is a message aimed not so much at their southern neighbours, but at the Americans. Here's Hyung-seo Lee, who escaped from North Korea when she was 17.
Everywhere in school we go, you know, there's a huge posters that we, as students, we are killing Americans with our pen or knife or gun, whatever. So we learned that Americans are our primary enemies. We thought Americans are not normal human being, because in North Korea we don't have a word American. We never learned that. We only learned American bastards. This is only one word.
In Seoul, the bars are open, people live their lives. The threat of nuclear annihilation has become part of the fabric of life. Most people genuinely believe it's never going to happen. But are they being naive? Here's Hyun-seo Lee again.
This time is not I'm worried about North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. What I'm worried about, Donald Trump. Right now, Kim Jong-un, he's really scared about Trump, I believe, because he knows that. He even can't predict about Trump.
You know the regime's mentality. What would be their reaction, his reaction, if he was pressed, if he felt threatened?
Click the nuclear button.
This is a game played for impossibly high stakes. Up until now, the rules have been clear. An escalation is punished by sanctions. Compromise is rewarded with sanction relief. And the key to keeping this Cold War cold has been one iron rule: no sudden movements.
The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse reporting there from South Korea. During World War II, many thousands of U.S. soldiers were stationed in Britain, including around 100,000 African-American troops. But in Britain, the strict rules of America's segregation did not apply. Here's how an instructional film for GIs explained the situation.
Now look, men, let's be frank about it. There are colored soldiers as well as white here, and there are less social restrictions in this country. Look, that might not happen at home, but the point is, we're not at home. And the point is, too, if we bring a lot of prejudices here, what are we going to do about them?
Some African-American soldiers formed relationships with white British women. Most went home after the conflict was over, but some left behind kids. And it wasn't always easy to be those kids. British writer Louisa Adjoa Parker has been exploring this history. So do you have a sense of what it was like growing up as a mixed-race kid in Britain at this time? What did you hear?
there was obviously a big stigma. There was a double stigma about being illegitimate, first of all, and then, of course, the skin colour was an extra sort of layer of stigma. I think Britain's sort of perspective on race was different to America's at the time. I think British people didn't support segregation as such, but there were prejudices towards non-white people based in sort of, you know, colonial attitudes, which were still sort of present.
Was there a stigma that these kids were fathered by Americans?
I'm sure there was, yeah. I think the British people who referred to them as tan yanks and, you know, the whole thing of they're over here, overpaid, oversexed type of thing. But I think on the whole, the African-American soldiers tended to be regarded, particularly in the West Country where I did my research, as more polite and more respectful. There's a really nice quote that a West Country farmer said, and he said, "I like those Americans, but I don't like those white ones they've brought with them."
There were some extraordinary stories that you found of when they were kids trying to assimilate and struggling, like a man named John Stockley, who tried all sorts of things when he was young that he thought would change the color of his skin. I mean, tell us about that, because it suggests some enormous torment.
He had a tough time growing up. His family wouldn't talk to him about his real father at all. He has very little information about his father. He did describe to me an experience that he had when, on a winter's day, a boy that he knew at school called him the N-word, and John retaliated by punching him on the nose, and he remembers very clearly seeing the blood on the snow. And immediately afterwards, he was marched off to the headmaster's office, and he remembers the headmaster saying to his mother, who was called into the school, "You have to remember, Mrs. Stockley, you cannot educate these people."
Wow.
And then he was caned. He was caned in front of his mother. John also told me that he used to drink milk of magnesia, and he used to also eat chalk to try and make himself turn white. I'm a sort of mixed heritage person, a lot younger than the GI babies, but I understand how they must have felt.
I was going to ask you that because you describe yourself as of English and Ghanaian heritage, but you also started, before we started chatting, you said you were very British. So I'm just wondering how much did their stories, these baby stories, resonate with you?
Well, they resonated quite a lot, really, because they have had a similar experience. It was just set sort of 3 decades before I was born. But I understand that feeling of being the only brown face. Although when I was born in the 70s, Britain was still quite a racist place to be. I think it had perhaps moved on a little bit from the 40s, although perhaps not very much. But there was positivity as well. You know, there were stories of love between some of the African-American GIs, you know, had loving relationships with the women here. And there was a sort of sense of hope in spite of the difficulties that the children and the mothers had been through.
British writer Louisa Adjoa Parker has been looking into the history of mixed-race GI babies in England. Thank you very much, Louisa.
Thank you.
When you write a song about racism, it's a big deal.
That's Aliou Touré, lead singer of Songoï Blues. They're from Mali. We played you some of their music earlier this summer, and since then, we've spoken with Touré. One of the songs he wanted to tell us about was about race. It's called One Color. This is a song that Touré hopes can provide a teachable moment about racism. It helps that the animating spirit behind it is a children's choir.
Together, yes, we can. Together, we can.
The children are not racist. When we went to at school to record this kid's voice, they were so beautiful with all the different kids from different countries, from Asian, India, US, from France, from Africa. They're all together, playing together, happy. It's so beautiful when you see kids like that. We said maybe the kids can educate the parent.
When we all come together, this life will be great. Like a drum, bass, guitar.
One Color is just one of the tunes on an album that is all about resistance. That is, in fact, the title of Songoï Blues' new CD, Resistance. They tackle racism along with preconceived notions of what Africa, Mali, and their home city of Bamako are all about. Stereotypes like the fiction that lawlessness and crime occur on every corner in Bamako. Aliou Touré says one way he likes fighting back is making music, because music brings people together. It is, says Aliou, a universal energy.
When you put 100 people in a small venue, you put the music on, everyone will be happy. When you turn the music off, everyone will be go on. Like, it's not interesting without music. So the thing with us is to turn all of these things happen around the world and to try to find a positive way to bring people together.
When we spoke with Aliou Touré recently, just before the group's U.S. tour, which starts next week, the biggest thing on his mind was voter apathy in Mali. The lack of voter turnout that seems to occur in every election in Mali, and there's another one next year. For Aliou Touré, 50 years of independence in Mali has not changed government corruption, for example, and a tenuous peace deal to bring stability to the north of Mali has not brought hope to many Malians. Songhai Blues is doing what they can to get out the vote. They open their album with the tune Voter, to vote. And that's what we'll end today's program with. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for tuning in.
PRI, Public Radio International.